You're listening to 101.9 FM, KPCR LP, Santa Cruz.
Hi, I'm Jarrett Keene, and you're listening to Drinks with Tony.
Get on the Drinks with Tony show, yeah.
You're listening to Drinks with Tony. I'm your host, Tony Duchesne. Today on the show, we have Jarrett Keene. He's the author of Hammer of the Dogs. Jarrett, how are you?
I am wonderful. So great to be here talking about post-apocalyptic adventure fiction set in ruined Las Vegas.
Do you think, when you say before you say post-apocalyptic fiction, sometimes it almost feels like nonfiction.
Yes. Right now, the Las Vegas Strip, the resorts are struggling with the cyber attack. I don't know if you read about it.
No, what's that?
MGM Resorts, Caesars, they've been hit with cyber malware, and their assets are being held for ransom.
And, really?
Yeah, huh. Caesars Palace paid the ransom. I think it came to $30 million. And MGM Resorts is holding out, trying to solve the problem, I guess, on their own. But it's difficult. You know, they're paying out the gambling winnings with cash, and everything's... you know, people are being locked out of their rooms and valets down, and it's just it's a big mess. So,
and living in Las Vegas, that's when you live in Las Vegas, what happens on the Strip is that something that's like pretty important, where it's like a communal type thing?
It's become increasingly technological here, so everybody's impacted and affected. And you know, I don't visit the Strip too often, but when I do, I'm always surprised how many people I know who work there, mainly my students. Got a lot of students here at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, who work in the hotels, the casinos, and their parents work there as well, their families. So, yeah, everybody's impacted by something like this, like a cyber attack on the properties.
Yeah, it's a huge part of the economy. The reason why...
It's the only... part of the economy.
Oh, is it essentially? Yeah.
I mean, Las Vegas and Nevada, you know, this is it's a big sand pit, a playground for everyone to test out their bad ideas, you know, like driverless cars and drones and you know, weapons and atomic bombs and stuff like that. So people always try out their new technology here. We're on the bleeding edge, you might say. And then whatever works here, they spread to the rest of the country, the world.
Yeah. So thanks for the driverless cars, Las Vegas. We appreciate you.
Yeah, we got Elon Musk drilling tunnels here and under the Strip, you know, to ease the traffic congestion. I don't know how that works, since it's like one vehicle at a time going up and down the through the tunnel up and down the Strip. But yeah, this is everybody gets to experiment on us. It's a bizarre place to live, and that's why I wanted to capture some of that weirdness with my novel Hammer of the Dogs, which is, you might say, a future shock that's only a few steps down the road.
Now, did you grow up in Vegas, or did you end up in Vegas?
No, I grew up in Tampa, Florida, death metal capital of the world.
Are you into death metal?
Oh, I love death metal.
Yeah.
I had a great childhood there, and when I was looking at colleges, I said, you know what, let's try University of Central Florida in Orlando, which is a big tourist destination. And then I got my PhD in creative writing at Florida State up in northern Florida, Tallahassee. And then I couldn't get a job, so I guess I found one here in Las Vegas. I started out as an entertainment reporter.
And for what magazine?
It was called Las Vegas City Life. It was a free weekly newspaper.
Oh, cool.
You know,
did it have a bunch of like hookers and porn in the back? Where
that's how we financed that thing. And they would come in, the sex workers would come in, and, you know, I'd hear them order, you know, decide what kind of ad they were going to run, you know, how many inches, how many dollars per hour. And, I learned a lot. I mean, I was a very sheltered really kid until I moved to Las Vegas at age 27. And then I learned very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's so cool that, the sex industry, support, actually is the only way that, supports, you know, a magazine. It's like,
Yeah.
It's so unique. Probably very unique to Vegas, I would think. I don't know. I guess we had them a lot when I was growing up in San Francisco too. I remember
Craigslist and everything else. The internet killed all that and caused the budgets to collapse. So
yeah,
that had an impact. But when I moved here, I did everything. I was a bar critic, food critic. I reviewed strip clubs for money, you know.
That's awesome. What does it take to review a strip club? So first you got to go in there.
Right.
Do you also like review like lap dances and the drinks how does a review of a strip club work?
Well, I mean, it all depends, right? Because it depends if the magazine is reimbursing you for any of these services.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So some of them you just sit in the corner and observe.
Observe, right. And make it more of a literary, ode, if you will. Like, you know, instead of ode to a Grecian urn, it's like ode to Cherry, the dancer at Little Garland or whatever. You know. And so it was a real opportunity, actually, to like stretch my writing techniques and strategies and having to write about all those different things, you know, food, bars, art, theater, film, music. I mean, it was a gift, really. They paid me very little. I think my starting salary in 2001 was like maybe 18 grand or something like that to be the editor of the entertainment section.
But sounds about right.
It was so valuable. I mean, it gave me an immediate introduction into Las Vegas, every aspect of it, especially the seedy underground parts. And that helped me publish one of my first books, which was called The Underground Guide to Las Vegas. And I wrote what was then, you know, what we might call an alternative guidebook to Sin City, which is, you know, where to go for the really gnarly stuff, you know.
Like I remember the underground guides. They were great.
They were a great series.
Yeah. So as you're delving into this and you're it seemed like you're really like diving into what Las Vegas was. What was your opinion when you came into Las Vegas, and then as you were really sinking into it, what changed about your idea of Las Vegas?
Well, I came in without an opinion, and I'm not sure I've actually formed one. It's such a unique, dynamic, always evolving, devolving environment. You know, when I got here, they were still imploding casinos, for example.
Right.
Building new ones. The boom was underway. And so it was hard to get a read. I just knew that things were happening fast. And what added to the complexity of it all was the fact that I got a call from the LA bureau chief of People magazine. And they wanted to hire me to basically become a stalkerazzi and just track these celebrities all through the hotel casinos and report on who they were with, what they were eating and drinking, what they were, you know, what kind of money they were gambling with. And that made it even more, I don't know what other word to use except surreal.
Yeah.
You know, I'd go to.
Did you have to get photos with that too? Or was it just document? Oh, really?
Photos. Yes. I mean, that wasn't my specialty. I was more of a writer. So they would hire additionally photographers, you know, to do the hardcore stalkerazzi-ing.
Yeah.
And I occasionally I'd have to use my phone or my work camera. So that gave me even more insight into the tabloid maelstrom that Vegas offers, especially for celebrities.
Yeah. And was there any celebrity where they were just like really cool about it and you're just going, oh man, where they just understood, yeah, I get it. There's that side of it.
Oh, they were always cool. I never met a mean celebrity in Las Vegas. Nobody ever hassled me.
Oh, that's
even
cool.
If it was, you know, even if they knew who I was sitting at the bar, you know, with my pad and pencil, you know, taking notes or, you know, paying the bartender, you know, $40 to get the receipt for Sandra Bullock's dining tab, you know, the itemized bill or whatever. Really shady, sketchy stuff. And so in many ways, now as a professor, I feel like I'm repenting for all my sins as a young journalist.
Sin City. No, so what so Was there any celebrity where you were like, were you starstruck at all? Like at some point? I mean, there's got to be a point where you're like, oh my God.
I never met, all my celebrities, all my favorite stars are either dead or really obscure, you know? So I'm sure Sandra Bullock is awesome, but I don't, you know, it didn't register for
me. But she was in Speed, man.
Yeah. it's a good movie. No, but, I was never starstruck. I was also like in a mercenary mode. I think that's part of the problem with Las Vegas is you tend to look at everybody as a, not a mark, but certainly as an opportunity to make a buck. And that kind of mentality in Las Vegas seeps into you, whether you're aware of it or not. And it can have an effect. You know, you start looking at stories as, you know, vehicles for money rather than, you know, intellectual or literary opportunities. They become, you know, like a paycheck. So,
right. So how do you grapple with that? And because you were saying that you were repenting for your sins now. Did you feel like you were sinning at the time, or you're just trying to like get as much writing experience as possible?
I wanted to absorb Vegas head on. I didn't want anything I didn't want to be held back in any way. Mm-hmm. And that's why when my friend at the casino said we could make more money writing employee newsletters than doing all this hustling, you know, this freelance hustling, I said, yeah, let's try that. And so that became another incredible experience and opportunity working in back of house, you know, in the basement of the Luxor, which is where the protagonist of my novel, Lash in Hammer of the Dog, that's where she spends too much of her time. You know, they're a hold up in the Luxor hiding from drone attacks. I worked in that space, you know, I worked in that hotel for many years. And I knew all those scenes, you know, like in the employee dining room. I knew about the Luxor Skybeam, how that was set up. I'd done tours through there. You know, I'd spent time in behind the scenes in Shark Reef Aquarium.
What's the employee dining room like? Is there tiers to the employee dining room where there's like, you know, if you're middle management, you go to this other dining room. If you're like CEO, you got another dining room.
We all eat in the same spot, the same communal area.
Yeah. Is it free or do you have to pay?
It's free to employees.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. So yeah, I put on some weight during that time, but you know, it was amazing because the properties would often compete with each other, you know, through the corporate challenges or just a simple, you know, charity run or hot dog eating contests. So it was just a minor extrapolation to see how these properties could serve as, you know, home bases for rival gangs operating with drones there in a broken Sin Cities. That's where the, you know, sort of the impetus for this novel emerged. But even more than that is
how long ago were you working in that Luxor in that environment?
Mid 2000s to let's see, about 2010.
Oh, okay. And then when did you get the when did you get the gig at UNLV?
I guess about 2012.
Yeah. Oh, so are you tenure now?
No, I went from PTI into teaching faculty to finally tenure just when COVID started.
Oh, okay. And what do you teach?
I teach American literature and the graphic novel.
Uh-huh.
And I love it. And yeah. It's a lot. It's my students especially love the comic book class.
You know, uh-huh.
Graphic novel is a fancy euphemism for, you know, comic book. I prefer the term comics. But, you know, but I teach graphic novel.
Yeah, I mean, they can get really literary. I remember, like, reading Sandman and reading Transmetropolitan and stuff. Yeah. And, like, those were just, you know, as I'm reading those, it felt like literature as there also just happens to be illustrations, you know?
Yes, they were headier, more intellectual, more challenging, more, I don't know. They were just, you know, that period from the mid-80s to roughly the early 2000s, it was unbelievable to see the kinds of, to see the evolution of the comic book. It was, It was almost miraculous, because even as sales plummeted, you know, Marvel going bankrupt, things like that, there was this energy, this creative energy at work in the medium.
Yeah. Now, nowadays, is there, you know, because I haven't really looked myself, and I try to keep looking here and there. Are there comic book series that are comparable to those, like, you know, Sandman? What was it, Transmetropolitan? There was a few others that were just like tight in those days. Is there comparable today, or did it kind of drop off?
I mean, not to my taste, but I mean, a lot of what I see is, you know, these huge corporate products that Marvel and DC put out, and to a lesser extent, you know, Image Comics, especially given the success of The Walking Dead. And there is some energy in the, what you might call, indie or alternative comic scene, but nothing like what you and I witnessed and experienced with, you know, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, for example, which was once again rebooted, made into a film in the last few months. And, you know, I just feel like that black and white comics boom that you and I saw, I think it has to come back. I think we have to get a little punk rock with comics, and maybe not worry so much about production value or, you know, the digital format, and get back to the, the way they do it in Japan, you know, which is lots of energy, lots of aggression, lots of, you know, just a vital art form, just taking risks and spewing it all out in black and white. I think we've got to get back to that.
And finding like the deep emotional core of these characters. Yes. And I think that's probably where I was drawn back in those days, where it's just like, we're going through the emotional arc that's when like my heart is stirred, and I haven't felt my heart stirred in too long since.
Yeah. Love and Rockets. Yeah. Great. The Crow was an amazing emotional journey. You know, there's just, I don't see that kind of investment in characters. I see a lot of identity memoirs, which are awesome, and, you know, those are always fun to read. But though they're very specific and particular to, they're almost like memoirs, you know, like memoir writing. They're very specific to the author, and you kind of have to go along with it. It doesn't really have that, what you might call, that kind of
craft.
Yeah, deep engagement with the technical and the emotional aspects of form at the same time.
It's rare, even in the book world. It's just like when it's memoir, it's just like, ooh, it's, you know, it's almost like the emotional truth in fiction, which is why I'm an insatiable fan of novels, because the emotional truth can be hit there. And it's, you know, sometimes it's hit in memoirs, but man, the percentage is way different. And it's, you know,
very different,
because a lot of memoirs and this happened, and they're buying it before it even goes out, before they even get a final draft, because it's a good idea. It's a property, you know, or your celebrity, which is even worse.
Oh yeah. That's a whole other, that's the challenge. But, you know, with this book, Hammer of the Dogs, I was trying.
Wait, what's it called again?
Hammer of the Dogs.
Oh, okay, because I didn't know.
I'm trying to.
You're pimping, well, people keep, man. It, you are pimping.
People keep calling it Hammer of the Gods because of the, you know, the Led Zeppelin biography from the 80s.
Yeah.
Do you remember that one?
No, but I looked at it and saw Hammer of the Gods when I, and I was just like, oh, no, it's dogs. That's pretty cool. That's so.
Yeah, I was trying to tap into that 80s. Energy from, you know, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles to Conan the Barbarian to Red Dawn, Empire Strikes Back. You know, I just feel like we've lost something in our move to make everything glossy and prestige and CGI'd. And
I agree.
Everything's so politically correct and polished, and, you know, it just feels too safe. And so I wanted to create something that was stepped outside of that and tried to.
Did you have to go? Was there a sensitivity editor on the way in this process? Oh, good, good. No. Yeah.
The book is loaded with the kind of violence that young people used to enjoy in Stephen King novels and John Milius movies and George Lucas projects, and
right,
it's a real throwback intentionally.
Yeah, know? Yeah. To just to actual good storytelling, right? It's not yeah. These books and movies need to be unsafe. It cracks me up. There's even the do you have a safe room at your college? Is there like
no? We do. But
yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, you know. I want to go into a safe room and just slap people because yeah. Life is not safe. Life is not safe. Even when you're in the room, it is not safe. You can have a heart attack here and die. We're all going to die. It's the human condition. Yeah, see, that's why no college hires me.
The safe room or safe space or whatever is
safe space. That's right.
Yeah, the safe space is the better. It's funny because in the casinos they have what's called the rubber room, which is where they rough you up when you've been card counting, and they
that still happens, right?
I don't think so. I don't think to the same degree, but
just wink if it does. And,
two winks if it is. No, the idea of creating a safe environment is fine. I just don't think everybody should be dragged into it if they're willing to, you know, look for riskier material or fiction or storytelling, you know.
Yeah, and I've learned too, it's because I've suffered majorly from anxiety and, you know, PTSD over the years, and the kind of going to a safe part is not how you heal it. It's how you make it worse. How you make it better is by being resilient and by pushing through and by embracing uncomfortable, unsafe, and embracing even total terror. That's where our brains can connect to new synapses and overcome things.
Well, that's funny that you say that, because that's exactly what Lash, the hero of the novel, is up to, is embracing the danger, embracing the technology, the lethal technology, learning how to use it so that it's not used against her.
Yeah.
So, because I feel like we're giving young people the wrong message, which is that, you know, they shouldn't, they should avoid these things or avoid understanding, you know, aggressive technology and finding these safe spaces. But no, I think sometimes we have to push young people to face the danger and figure out a way to solve it, to thwart it, to twist it to their own advantage. You know, that's what my book is about. That's what Lash is all about. And you remember those sci-fi adventures that we loved, Ellen Ripley in the Aliens franchise, Sarah Connor in Terminator. You know, these were unbelievable stories, sagas, and I wanted to harken back to that and you know, have Lash face off against monster after monster, each one more insidious and lethal than the next. And I didn't want there to be any safe spaces. I wanted her to face off against these monsters, you know, find a way to defeat them. And yeah, that's the kind of the lesson of the book that I want to impart to young readers and older readers.
And older grizzled fellas.
Like ourselves.
Yeah, it's funny because I teach screenwriting now, but I used to teach novel. And the novels over the years that these kids bring in are just getting safer and safer and happier. And it's just fantasy. It's just, and I'm like, you need conflict. And there's a point of no comprehension of conflict. And that's why I love teaching screenwriting so much more. Cause I'm just like, dude, conflict on every page or you're not getting a film made. I just had to stop teaching novel writing at UCLA Extension. I'm just like, I'm just so happy that everything's okay and everything's all right and everyone's just it's safe space culture that's just been brought into I'll make a pretty novel, and it's just like novels are supposed to be dirty and ugly.
Yes. The other thing that's come up, or the other I guess evolution you might say in fiction writing, is the flash fiction, you know, the micro fiction, the short story. These are like vignettes that don't really offer much in the way of plot or conflict. But I find that an increasing number of students every year really gravitate towards that form. So I'm left wondering, is this maybe the future of storytelling is plotless or conflict free, or maybe that's what storytelling will look like in 10 or 20 years.
Oh, how boring. I mean, I hope not. I'm so glad I'm going to die within the next four decades.
I hope not, but
you know, they'll say it's autoerotic asphyxiation, but it'll just be a straight hanging.
I'm not gonna lie to you. I mean, when I wrote this novel, I didn't write it so much to, you know, to for my own pleasure. I wrote it to show my students how to write a episodic, you know, story where chapter after chapter there was some sort of a cliffhanger at the end of each chapter. And I wanted to.
Were you using it in your classes? Were you saying, "Hey, here's where I'm at, and let's look at how this chapter ends with a reason to turn the page to the next chapter," kind of thing?
Yeah, every week for a 15 week semester, you've taught, you know, this. I'd bring in a new chapter from the book, you know. So I'd
write. So you got to workshop. You got to workshop and teach.
Yes, but that wasn't the goal. I wasn't like dying for their feedback or, you know, I mean, they're great students, but. Yeah. I wasn't so concerned that they were going to fix my, you know, my novel in progress, but I wanted to show them what a sustained, disciplined effort it takes to, you know, produce a chunk of a novel. And you do that by writing 2,000 to 3,000 words every week minimum. Yeah. So I'd bring that in. And you know what? What's amazing, what happened is they started working on their own novels and bringing in chapters and short stories. And so we would just turn the whole class for that semester into a workshop. You know, we'd show up, read our 2,000, 3,000 words, and we'd give some feedback. Nothing mean, nothing like, nothing unhelpful or savage. We would just say, right. I like this, I like that. Maybe you could do some of this.
Yeah.
But to watch them work on their novels and then a semester later, you know, watch them publish some of these novels or many short stories, a few nonfictions and poems. I mean, that was so rewarding to inspire students. I didn't inspire them. I just kind of encouraged them to get work done every week. And they thought it was fun. And that's how they learned. I mean, if you make stuff fun for students, they want to learn and they want to do.
And just bringing in the whole process into a classroom environment is a great idea.
Yes.
That's but now have your students that you showed this novel, were they seen the book yet? Or are they, have you? Yeah. And
how really,
go ahead.
They're really happy for me. And I say, I'm glad you're happy for me, but where is your novel? Where's your next book?
Right. I'm glad you've written a lot of books, so you understand that your pub day was last week.
Yes, it was.
It monumentally feels uneventful. It's because because we're supposed to be raised above the clouds because we are the gods of our stories and we are the chosen to tell these stories. And then all of a sudden it's pub day and then it's just like, oh, and there it went.
Yeah.
So you get to impart that knowledge on them too, and just kind of go, the process is what's important, not the outcome, even though we like good outcome.
I told my students today, I was like, I spent yesterday driving from Barnes & Noble to Barnes & Noble, pulling my novel, which was always misshelved in like, you know, dark fantasy or true crime, or I don't know, the religious section or something, and taking it out and putting it in the science fiction section, talking to the manager and saying, "Hey, I think my book belongs here." And then, you know, because it's unglamorous. I have to like shepherd my own book into the proper shelving category here in the local bookstores, but it's fine. It's what it is. You know, it's not everything goes according to plan. You just have to roll with it and understand that it's not personal. It's just, there's a lot of books out there and you've got to just watch over your product and make sure it's represented the best way possible.
Did you have an opening? Did you have a release party last week or a release?
I did at we did at the Writer's Block bookstore here in downtown Las Vegas.
Yeah.
It was wonderful. SRO, we sold 40 copies. That's all they had.
Isn't that like wonderful, but drive you mad at once?
Yes. Yes.
Oh great, we sold out. Why weren't you people thinking ahead?
No, I mean, they did everything they could to promote it, and they've given me a good what do you call it, acreage there in the bookstore, so I'm very grateful. But yeah, I mean, you never know with these things. Like 20 minutes before the signing, I thought nobody was going to show up, and then, you know, they started like mobbing the place.
That's great. Yeah.
You know, 15 minutes beforehand. And then I started to breathe a little easier. Like, okay, we're going to have some people here. This is great. And then I was worried the fire department was going to show up and close it all down. And
which would have been great, because then you get the video of that, and then that goes viral. It's just, you know, you're like, everyone stand your ground, don't leave, let's all get arrested. Yeah. And then all of a sudden it's TikTok, it's viral, and then you quit your job at UNLV and just go live in another. Where would you live if you didn't have the greatness of your situation in Las Vegas? Where would you live if you had your choice of any other place in the world?
Man, anywhere that's green. Las Vegas is very beige.
Someone's missing water.
Yes. I miss Florida. I mean, that's so green there. It's so much. Yeah. Yeah, there's water. I love growing up in that area. I feel a little bad for my sons because they've been raised here in the beige expanse of, the Vegas Valley. Yeah. But I will tell you this about the area. You know, once you get outside the valley, it's beautiful. You know, Valley of Fire, Red Rock National Park, Lake Mead. You know, there's so many outdoors. And Utah is just a hop, skip, and a jump away. And, Zion is nearby. And it's just so lovely everywhere but Las Vegas. Yeah. Las Vegas, like I said, is this sand pit full of technology. And that's what, I try to do with this book, is show this different side of Vegas that no one really explores. And they haven't really explored it to my satisfaction until now. You know, I wanted to show that this is a place that's beautiful and dangerous, you know, lethal and promising. You can come here and establish yourself right away. You can reinvent yourself countless times in Las Vegas. The price, of course, is that you're living in Las Vegas.
Now why is it that you can reinvent yourself? Is it because there's so much turnover of community?
Yes.
Is that the
that's exactly why. And not only that everything changes. So, you know, the technology develops, the properties shift, even the university here, it's always in flux. And so there's so many opportunities for employment, for, you know, side hustles, freelance work. You can make a life in Las Vegas. It's still more affordable than California.
Yeah, you just had me go, wait a second, maybe I should check on the faculty openings at UNLV after we're done with this, and just throw it out there.
Well, not just faculty, you know, there's like administrative staff. There's all kinds of jobs everywhere in the hotel sector, and also the tech sector. You know,
I don't want to work in those. No.
But I mean,
I can only do writing and teaching. If I do anything else, I'll do it part time, and I'll quit within 3 months when I got money to stop and go back to teaching and writing.
No, I've had students find work, you know, writing stuff for Raytheon or the test site, or there's all kinds of military stuff happening here. There's just jobs. Oh,
yeah,
everywhere. And there's very few cities like that where you can find all kinds of, you know, work. Usually, right. We have one game in town, but we also are a city that has what you might call adjacent industries. You know, and I think the hotel industry and the military industrial complex are more in sync than people realize. You know? And that's what I was trying to get at with this adventure. And I was showing Vegas as a city that we take for granted, or we just have this, you know, simple mythic idea about, but it's a lot scarier and a lot more dynamic than people understand.
Yeah.
Especially with these drone tech conventions, man, these drone tech conventions that come to Las Vegas.
We can kill a whole wedding party with one button.
I showed up in my employee badge, you know, and just kind of snuck into these gatherings of the drone sector. And man, the weapons just got scarier and scarier every year.
Yeah.
And that connection between, you know, the tech sector, law enforcement, the military, higher education, the casinos, foreign governments, it was astounding to witness. They're all working in sync to sharpen and escalate this drone surveillance weapon technology.
Yeah, and what do they need in order to fill that? They need even more conflict to happen.
Yes.
Wait, we don't have enough people in fear. Let's create another border crisis somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, a border crisis and just straight up conflict, like in Ukraine. You know, that's the way I look at it, is just a great opportunity for everyone to test out their latest weapons.
And, yeah, it's so utterly sad, and it's just like, my God, it just, you know. What's that?
We have Creech Air Force Base here, which oversaw many of those drone operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know.
Yeah.
So you have a remote drone pilot, you know, killing people thousands and thousands of miles away. Just do that for some hours and then drive home to their Las Vegas suburban house.
And there was a movie. There was a movie on that with Helen Mirren and Aaron Paul. Yeah. Do you remember what was that movie called? Do you remember?
I can't recall, but yeah, I remember seeing it. There's also National Bird, the documentary.
Yeah,
which is pretty startling to watch. But I mean, it's just one of those things where it's only going to get scarier with the AI technology.
Yeah.
Soon there won't be any remote piloting. The computer will just be doing it itself.
Right. And what we'll have is they'll have our Facebook post connected to our brain, and they'll just know to shoot us if we don't think correctly.
Yeah. I mean, I was shocked just this weekend. I mean, there was the conservative politician who was vaping during a musical production or groped or getting groped or something. And they have all these cameras inside the theater with this like infrared night visions technology, you know, monitoring and following the two of them, her and her date, like through the theater and out to the foyer and down to the parking garage and down the street. And I was like, my goodness, how do they have all this technology? Well, it's because they, you know, they paid for it. And, you know, post 9/11, you can probably still apply for grants to get all this surveillance tech, and it's just going to get wilder, I think, until there's literally hovering above us,
You know,
a few feet above our heads, just watching us as we.
Aren't they even doing that? And what was that in New York City? They were the law enforcement was just like throwing drones up there, and it's just like, wow, you know, you'd be like. 20 years ago, those would be shot down by people in the neighborhood, and we would be applauding the people who shot them down. We'd be like, thank you. Who's next? Thank you. Who's next? And it's just, and then all of a sudden, just how things become acceptable.
Passivity. Yeah. We've all become passive to it. And the cartels, I don't know if you read that story. The cartels are buying drones off Amazon and improvising explosives and just dropping bombs on each other.
Wow.
It's just a matter of time before a kid here or anywhere figures out how to do that and launches an attack on classmates, someone they don't like. You know, it's scary to contemplate. That's where my novel is, you know, trying to mine, to explore that gruesome
possibility. So your novel's a warning.
It is, but it's also, I mean, I wrote it as something fun, like, to go back to that 80s movie metaphor, you know, movies back then had a bright darkness. So they were, you know, they had a gloomy premise, but in the end, the hero wins and triumphs, and the Goonies, you know, save their neighborhood, and the, you know, the bad guys get their comeuppance at the end. And that's what I wanted to achieve with this. I didn't want to write like a cynical, pessimistic, paranoid Philip K. Dick, you know, there's no hope, just forget about it.
But do you have that sometimes in your heart, that there's no hope?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I grew up revering Philip K. Dick, Margaret Atwood.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm kind of done with that. I wanted to do something different. You know, this is sort of a challenge, not just to myself, but, you know, to my students, to like think about ways to affect change. And I think the way to do it is to embrace the danger to an extent. And figure out how to wield this technology rather than have it wielded against you, you know?
Yeah, at the same time, I don't got too much hope about that. So
I mean, you can be pessimistic about it, but if you, I think there are victories everywhere we look. I mean, people are doing cool things and, you know, resisting and rebelling in small ways. And
yeah,
that's important, because if you just do what you're told and, you know, follow the rules that are provided by to you by, you know, an authority, it's, it will not always end well. I mean, it's,
Not only that, it it'll zap your soul, and and the soul is, I mean, we got to be true and authentic to ourselves, and when we're true and authentic to ourselves, then that's when we like feel better in the world, and we have better relationships, and I feel like that's why we're not going to lose the novel. I feel like the medium of the novel is going to come back at some point, because the long form of storytelling and even reading classics brings us back to the oh wait, we're all human, and we need to dive into these writers' heads for 6 hours, 12 hours, and have that long form communication. I just started reading Brothers Krom, I can't even pronounce it now, Dostoevsky
Karamazov.
I just started reading that. I've never read it, and it's just, and I'm so excited to get into it, because I know that it's going to inform me of what's happening now, even though it's such a novel from so long ago. It's almost like talking to the dead and talking to the ancients who are going, hey, this has all happened before.
Yeah. Well, I'm always I'm always surprised by how much the Iliad or the Odyssey resonates in the current moment, you know, especially the this idea of Hector and Paris, you know, the dutiful prince of Troy, son of King Priam, matched up with his wayward, you know, excuse of a brother, Paris, who, because he's spoiled and because he's selfish, ends up putting the whole city at risk of invasion from the Greeks. And, you know, Homer is communicating a message to us across time, you know, which is that, you know, if you're selfish, if you're, you know, too emotional and too and only think about yourself, you really risk putting everyone in danger. And I think about that a lot, because you know, we've become such a selfish culture to a degree, you know, with our bingeable TV and our door dashing and our all of these things I do. I'm just saying that we become a little spoiled, a little soft, a little, we're putting the fabric of our existence at risk with this idea that we're going to plug in some sentences into a ChatGPT box, and we're going to get a student paper, you know, there presented before us to copy and paste. It's a little much. It's getting a little ridiculous, and we're going to have to come to terms with it.
Yeah. And it's, you know, those people that do that are just, they're going to lose out. The ones that buy into it are going to lose out. Like, even self-checkout at grocery stores, I just hate it. And if I look at a line and the line looks like it's going to be like within 5 minutes, or I can leave immediately with a checkout, I stand in the line for 5 minutes. Right. And then I actually have conversations with people who are in line with me. And the checker, and the checker remembers me and is like, hey, how you been? And I'm like, good. And it's just like, we need those interactions all the time. We, you know, this, if you don't, what do you call it? When you get a kid out into the world to go,
fly, be free.
Yeah. Right. If you don't interact, if you're not interacting with anyone, that's when we go crazy.
Yes. So
it's almost like they're trying to make us go crazy when, you know, with DoorDash, which I've done too, where it's just like, put it by the door. You know, it's just like, so you're not even seeing your DoorDash guy. So there's a constant isolating, which is brutal for our brains, which we found out during lockdowns. It's just like, wait a second, where is the mental, where's the mental crazy stats?
We have gone crazy, Tony. I mean, just look at social media. I mean, that's the craziest place you could ever hope to spend any time in. And it's, it's not getting any better. It's just getting worse, and it sort of sucks in. Like, you try to keep a positive vibe there on social media, you ignore all the political stuff from every direction, and then you find yourself like typing something you never typed about, like I can't believe this is happening. It's a total, you know, what? There's nothing you can do to affect it. It doesn't affect you or anyone in your family, but you're going to come out with this this statement. You're going to come in, or you know, you find yourself struggling to make a connection between some doom scrolling headline. I mean, why are we doing this? It's, you know, it's hard. It's tempting because you want to participate, but you want to interact.
Yeah.
But it just seems to encourage negative energy and cynical, you know, garbage. So I've tried to make the book that I wrote address the subjects, but I wanted to let people know that, you know, we don't have to live the way that we've been living. You know, that the future shock of Las Vegas is just one option.
Right.
The rest of it is up to us. We can shape our future, our you know, we can shape our lives if we take control of our lives. And sometimes that requires grabbing the technology and making it do what we want it to do rather than what other people want it to do, which is track us, exploit us, use algorithms to oppress us, etc.
And that's why I still haven't put any DNA thing, you know, those people who are like, oh, I did 23andMe and I'm like 1.23% Scottish, and I'm like, you don't send that, do not send that information. They may, they, you paid for that too. It's like, are you crazy?
No, I don't do anything anymore. LinkedIn, I'm gonna get rid of that. I'm not giving stuff for free anymore. It's too ridiculous because they find a way to exploit you.
Yeah, I know it's gonna come up when I turn in my novel that I'm almost done with to my agent, and then hopefully it gets purchased by the, you know, with a huge advance, which is what we all pray for, right? And then it comes in, and you're like, oh, I've made less than minimum wage making this,
but
I still wouldn't change a thing because I had to make it.
No,
but at the same time, I know that it's going to be like, how many followers do you have? And the minute I get that question, I'm going to be like, I'm not on social media, and I'm going to shut down all of my social media because it's just like, no, I'm not playing that. It's these people, you know, these people are cheating it. They're buying bots. They're doing all this stuff. And it's just like, I'm writing to be authentic. So how about this? I got no social media.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have a website on geocities.com/tilde964. Remember the GeoCities website?
Do you really still have that website or no?
No, I'm kidding. Wouldn't that be rad though?
Angel Fire, Light Coast.
Dude, those were the big what do you call it? That was the big technology at the time. GeoCities? Oh wait, and we, you know, and then that's when we learned the word tilde.
Yeah, in 1998, that was it. But you know, the thing too is I feel like I am the only person who has ever purchased a book from seeing a social media post or something. I just don't believe that units move because of social media. I think units move in other ways, you know, like you know, book readings, book appearances, you know, word of mouth, you know, reviews online and stuff like that. I just don't see how posting a clip from my book trailer is going to
right. At the same time, there's people I follow that I'm friends with that we just, you know, we talk about our books sometimes, but then I'll see their like stack of like, oh, this is my summer reading. And I go through and I go, wait, that sounds cool. And then I look it up and I'm like, I got to read that. And
I do that all the time.
Yeah, and I'm posting my books that I'm reading like all the time on Instagram. If I'm on my next book, I post a little thing about having coffee and reading this book. And then people are like, oh, and it connects people too. Damn it. And that's the good thing about social media. Because then people
what you're doing though, you're promoting other people's work. But when I, you know, what I'm saying is like, if you post your novels, you know, here's the book trailer, blah, blah,
right,
blah.
Right, right, right.
People read that as, well, this is just the guy. But what you're saying is more intriguing because you're saying, here's what I'm up to, here's what I'm reading, here's what's on my
mind.
That to me is more interesting than some guy, you know, he keeps posting the same photo of his reading, his event, his book, whatever.
And I'm turned off. You're right. I'm turned off by that. Yes. I don't know if that's a Gen X thing either, because I think, you know, we come from an era where it's just like, you got to find it. You got to dig through the vinyl, man.
Work.
Yeah. It's just like, go find it yourself. I'm not going to carry you to this place. And then as the whole generation, like below us, is just carrying people to the place. And they're like, well, we're going to go there. Cause I got carried.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I'm always intrigued to find out what other writers are reading or excited about. So in that way, I think you're right. Social media can be valuable.
Yeah.
I just bought a book today that's self-published that was posted on another author's Instagram that the author wasn't involved in. You know, she posted, "Hey, check out this new book on Black Sabbath," and it's, you know, it's self-published through Amazon POD or something. I ordered it. I gotta have that.
Yeah. In Vegas, have you found any good death metal bands?
Let's see. No, I haven't.
Yeah. Do they tour? Do they tour through? Do you still get to go out and see band?
We've had a few tours. We have what's that big one that was at the Palms every year? I'm blanking on it. There was Doom in June, which used to be here every year.
Wow.
See, because I'm a professor,
I only know Punk Rock Bowling. That's the only one I know.
Yeah. Well, that was I think they're still doing that. You know, I'm sure Pennywise is headlining.
Right, yeah.
But we have the Punk Rock Museum here, which I highly recommend that you check out if you like.
Yeah. My friend, a lot of her zines and stuff are on display there. I want to get there check it out. Yeah.
Yeah. You should come look at that. But as far as death metal, no, I mean, and since I've gone straight and become a professor, you know, I don't, I'm not a music writer anymore, so I don't stay out late getting my eardrums blown out. But, you know, I think, too, tell me if you think this is true. I think a lot of death metal has become monotonous and monochromatic. I think the digital recording techniques have tended to flatten bands' sounds. It's made them less distinctive. They seem to be all using the same editing software or recording software.
Oh, right. And putting it through the same filters. So it's another mass production.
Sound studio sound is gone. You know, like every studio used to have its own distinct sound back in the 80s,
right,
and well into the 90s. But today it's all like, feels processed, feels like polyester or something.
It's like recently, like this is very recently, I just got back into jazz again, and I'm just like, I'm on a Coltrane, Miles Davis, just going down. I think everything just kind of completely bored me all of a sudden, or I bore myself often too. You know, when you're in your own head and you're just like, God, why would anyone listen to anything I say or write? Because I bore me so much. And then you're like, okay, wait, well, let me shake it up. And so I was just like, let me be the jazz guy again. And I used to have a ton of jazz records when I lived in San Francisco, and it's just like, God, I miss all those jazz records. Cause I used to just put them on and it would just be in the background as I read books. And it's just like, I need to get back to that again. I like that.
Well, since you're just talking about jazz, you probably are familiar with the Van Gelder studio, which is where Coltrane recorded a lot of his later works. I think it was Jersey somewhere. But if you find those discs, those records, you'll notice that studio has a distinctive sound. You know, you start to recognize it as you listen to Coltrane's works.
Interesting. Yeah, I've never thought of it that way. Huh?
Yeah, it's the complete antithesis of homogenized, processed, you know, music, which unfortunately is what I feel like we're dealing with. I've almost made a promise not to listen to anything recorded after, 1995 because of I just want it to be, analog, and then, digitally transferred is fine.
Right, but right.
I just prefer that organic, reel-to-reel, sound of recorded music. I don't want to deal with anything that's been digitally, recorded or mishandled. But I'm kind of a snob that way. So,
yeah.
And I with my novel, I wanted to create something that was not, what do you call it? Workshopped. I mean, the book was peer reviewed, but it wasn't, what do you call it? It wasn't me sitting around with some other people at the publishing house and, we're going to do this and that. And we're going to sell a whole bunch of books.
No, I can't believe sensitivity editor is just such a normal thing. And I know the book that I'm about to turn in is, it's not going to get by any sensitivity editor. So it just might be, guess what? You're going with a small publisher. Because I'm not in, guys. I'm not playing this game. It's, let people be offended and let's get out of safe space.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, me and you showing up here today wasn't a safe space. We didn't know what would happen.
I barely know the outcome.
Yeah. It's just like, great. I got to talk. You're like, I got to talk to this guy. What? And I'm like, I've never met this guy. This could be horrible. You know, it's just like, if we wanted a safe space, we wouldn't even be talking, but we're unsafe. And here we are.
Yes. And I love the fact that you write about, or your the book previous to the one you're coming out with, you write about young people and the pressures of that, the anxiety and the agony of adolescence. You know, it's a hard thing, and I see it now even more clearly watching my sons go through high school. You know, it's just it's a battle.
I think I'm well attuned in with the agony of middle age too. So I don't think it's ever ended.
Was that what your next novel? Is that what your book's about?
the agony, the agony of a colonoscopy at 50.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I got to do that. But it's all right.
Oh, you guys still haven't done your colonoscopy yet?
Well, I just turned 50, so I got to do it now.
Oh yeah. No, you got to go get it because you know, it used to be you'd ask a girl out and she would say yes. And it was like the best thing you've ever heard in your life. When your doctor calls you after your colonoscopy and he says, you're all clear. It's the same thing.
Now I can enjoy life.
Yeah. Yeah. Body. You're just like, oh my God, I'm good. I'll see you in 10 years. All right. Jared, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Tony. It was a pleasure. Let's do it again.
Making the bombs. I install electronic components, the little chips that know where home is. I get a thrill going through my section when I give them my final inspection. I like the kind to save the buildings. I take it out, I'll finish the stone. You gotta kill, you gotta maim. The real estate is not to blame. Making the bombs, making the bombs, making the bombs, making the bombs, making the world a nicer place. Lunchtime whistle. I don't go out to eat. I'd rather stick around
and polish a couple of cruise missiles.
You're listening to 101.9 FM, KPCR LP, Santa Cruz.